I must say, I can fully understand now why the British didn't have a chance when it came to a scrap in Boston, because you've got such staying power. I mean, here you still are when you could have slipped away quietly into the night. Here's me talking about David finding refuge elsewhere. You could have found a Dunkin' Donut shop somewhere around or a friendly ice cream parlor, and I'd never have been able to track you down. But you see, David's experience now was coming to an end, in the sense that the wilderness was almost over. If he had only known it, he was on the brink of the land. But, well, he lost concentration for a moment and went off in a different way. Have you thought how long David had been in the situation? It's difficult to be sure, of course, about the chronology. We do know that by the time he came to become king at Hebron, he was 30 years old. But we don't know quite how old he was when he was anointed by Samuel, or when he entered Saul's court, or when he fought with Goliath. Just imagine for a moment that he was 18 when he fought with Goliath. It follows, therefore, doesn't it, that for all that time, in the intervening years from 18 through to 30, he had been in the wilderness. Well, he would have had a brief occurrence whilst he was a courtier, perhaps a couple of years there, but maybe he'd been 20 when he had been outlawed. So 10 years had passed, and he was still to be found, by now, of course, a grown-up man, a man who was surely ready on any of these various occasions when he had stopped and taken stock, a man who was doubtless as prepared as he would ever need to be. But on the very brink of the kingdom, he decides to slip off into security. Well, think how that parallels with our own position. Here we, on the very edge, aren't we, of the time when God will call us to be kings and priests by his grace. We could so easily say, oh, I fancy a bit of comfort. I fancy a bit of rest. I fancy a bit of security. It's 1 Samuel chapter 27 that presents us with that position. He's only just said to Saul, as he did, that he's nothing but a dead dog, a partridge, a flea, and he's a nobody, the king's servant, when in 1 Samuel 27, David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul, for there is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul should despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand. And so he arose and passed over with the 600 men that were with him. Just pause and think about that for a moment. Think of the logistics of feeding 600 men. I understand your minds will be automatically turning anyway towards feeding and towards succor. But 600 men. It'd be a big job, wouldn't it, to feed 600 men here today with all the provisions around us. But 600 men in the wilderness, when you're fugitives, all of you, with all the difficulties and all the family links that there would have been with the villages and the towns round about. Well, David had regularly been feeding those 600, or had been responsible for them, and now he decides to slip away to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. Achish is a title, the same way as Pharaoh would be. So in that sense, it may not be the same man that had earlier encountered David with all the dribble going down his beard, remember, and had said, mad men, I got mad men enough, clear him out. Maybe it was a later successor to the same title. But this time, Achish, king of Gath, welcomes David, and notice what the detail is in verse 3. David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. And he was told Saul that David was fled to Gath, and he sought no more again for him. On the face of it, it poses us with a bit of a problem, a sort of a curious little quirk. Why is it now that Achish, king of Gath, should not only receive and accept David, but should give him a city, Ziklag, which was his as a possession? What had changed since David, the slayer of 10,000 Philistines, had come to him before in Gath? Well, a lot had changed, of course. 10 years of outlaw wandering had taken place. And those 10 years had confirmed, beyond any shadow of doubt, that David was Saul's enemy. And again, you can hear the Philistine logic, can't you? David, Saul's enemy, Philistine, Saul's enemy, equals David, Philistine's friend. Ah, yes. So they'd accepted him on board and they'd settled him in Ziklag. Because now David was on the same side as them. He was opposed to Saul. And David was prepared to play along with that little parable, well, that little deceit, for some long time, some 16 months now, during which he stayed in Ziklag. But notice the detail again that we passed over at verse 3, that he comes there with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. Abigail's experience, and it's not without some difficulty here, but Abigail's experience is typical of what had been happening as far as Israel was concerned during David's sojourn of 10 years or so in the wilderness. What do you think the people of Israel made of David? I mean, did they regard him as a refugee, a troubler of Israel? Or did they regard him as a sort of Robin Hood who was feeding off those who were rich and giving to those who were poor? Well, you get an insight into that from Abigail's experience. You remember the position back in 1 Samuel chapter 25. There was this man in Carmel. So again, it wasn't far from where David had been. Carmel, remember, between En-Gedi and Ziklag, going across on the line from east to west. And there at Carmel, well, there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel, says 1 Samuel 25 and verse 2. The man was very great, 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. And suddenly you get the sense of what David was about. Because now it's shearing time and slaying time, and they're all having a bit of a banquet. And David sends a polite request to say, don't forget us, we could do with a little bit of succor. Don't forget that we have been shepherding your flocks. And the men say, yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, all this time that David and his men have been there, just imagine a stray sheep from the Carmel flock, from Nabal's flock, coming across David's line of fire. Just imagine the thought of the succulent lamb that there would be. In all that time, they hadn't lost a sheep. Indeed, David and his men had been shepherding themselves. They had been safeguarding Nabal's possession. So when he sends and Nabal says, no way. You remember what he says there at verse 10? And he asks the question that David was asking himself. Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I've killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? That was a very dangerous thing to ask. Because it was one thing for David to say, who am I? I'm a nobody. It was a very different thing for a man to say, who is David? He's merely a runaway slave. Why should I feed him and his men? And instantly David does something which is completely out of character. The one thing that he had done and done and done again, we've seen two instances of it. Firstly, when they were at the cave in En-Gedi, and then later on when David and Saul encountered one another in the open, in the wilderness of Ziph. We have seen David withhold his hand from taking action on his own behalf. Now that was a characteristic that he had developed. It was part of his humility. It's very hard for us, isn't it? And yet we are commanded to do the same thing. You know, if somebody slaps us across the face, the natural reaction is that your own hand goes back. But Jesus says, turn again the other cheek also. And David had learned that passivity. That self-control. He was able to put the self to death. But in this instance, something snaps in his mind. Doubtless it was the thought of the mutton that was being roasted down in the camp and all the prospects that had been there. You could get to dream of food, couldn't you? I once remember visiting Nigeria and dreaming of cheese night after night. And the minute I got back to England, asking, could I have a plate of cheese, please? I didn't care whether it was roasted or grated or however it was. I just needed cheese. Well, David was doubtless a man like us with similar passions. And so this time, he girds his own sword on. 400 of his men out of the 600 go hurtling down towards Nabal's camp, and 200 of them stay with the spoil. Just watch for that little detail. 400 and 200. David has that aspect of the people who stay at home and the people who go out to war. It's the same pattern with us, isn't it, in our ecclesial endeavours, in our work in the brotherhood. There are those who go and there are those who stay. And each of those functions are regarded as absolutely vital and important. There are those who care for the children, there are those who sit in the meeting. There are those who go out preaching, there are those who stay at home praying. All those functions are part of the total purpose of God. And in this instance, the 400 go down hot foot, intent upon taking vengeance. And we started down this trail because Abigail now gives us an insight into what people thought of David during those intervening years. There she is at verse 26, stopping David in his tracks. "Now therefore, my lord, as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, seeing the Lord hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, now let thine enemies and they that seek evil to my lord be as Nabal. And now this blessing which thine handmaid hath brought unto my lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my lord. I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid. For the Lord will certainly make thy, my lord, a sure house. Because my lord fighteth the battles of the Lord. And evil hath not been found in thee all thy days. Yet a man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul, but the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God, and the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling." And caught there in verse 29 are a couple of vivid pictures. Just imagine David with his few possessions around him, and suddenly said, "It's Saul and his men!" And you scoop them together into the bundle, and before you know it, you've got the bundle over your shoulder and you're off. Well, she said, God will scoop you up into his bundle. When it comes time for you to move, God will carry you along with him too. That's the one picture. And the other, well, it's the picture of the Valley of Elah, isn't it? She says, your enemies, they will be hurled out as out of the middle of a sling. And so you can almost see the sense in which the folklore associated with David and his exploits have been now steeped in the minds of the men and women of Israel. They look at this man, this outlaw, and this refugee, and they see there a good man who has done nothing wrong. They see the enmity. They see the way of his self-control. And it's not a bit of wonder that they want to come to be with him. And we've talked, haven't we, as though in the session so far, women weren't associated with David and weren't giving any assistance. Sister came and quietly mentioned to me, don't forget David's wife, whom he had left behind, Michal, who had to look after the kids and who had to man and manage the house when he was out on the outlaw trail. And now don't forget Abigail, because when God strikes Nabal dead, Abigail, in fact, leaves her possessions and her affluence, and we've seen what they were, and verse 42 of 1 Samuel 25, she hasted and arose and rode upon an ass with five damsels of hers that went after her. She went after the messengers of David and became his wife. And I said it was a little curious because of verse 43. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were also both of them his wives. But Saul had given Michal his daughter, David's wife, to Phalti the son of Laish, which was of Galim. It leaves a bit of a sour taste in the mouth, doesn't it, verse 43, that David took another woman with him too. But I rather suspect that this was the actual outcome, that what was happening was that when Abigail, wise woman as she was, came with a clutch of her damsels, that David, realizing the awkwardness of living in a cave, you know, with men around and she and he as man and wife, actually said to her, bring one of your servants with you too. So that, although I may be wrong in this, I rather suspect that Ahinoam of Jezreel was one of Abigail's servant girls. So that he took a wife and her servant, who also in that sense became a secondary wife. And clearly he was to enlarge his family in that way and to get himself into a very complicated position. God, for the hardness of men's hearts, allowed provisions that were less than the ideal in these early times. But it's worth noticing that the more the ideal is breached, the more complicated life becomes. Well, those of us who've got one husband or one wife, we know that there are complications enough in that relationship, and to take another of either sex would be equally complicated, and who'd want a whole harem of wives or a whole group of husbands if the choice came? So that God does allow some accommodation in this instance for human need, and David was a man who loved passionately, and as a consequence, his passion sometimes drew him into some difficulty. So he had moved from less than the ideal as far as his family life was concerned, and yet God had accepted and accommodated it, and now he moves from less than ideal with regard to Ziklag. He goes and he settles in Ziklag, and there in Ziklag he lives a life of duplicity and deceit. You remember the message he always said, "I've been striking against the people of Israel." And he came back and he shared booty and spoil with his sovereign lord, Achish, king of Gath, but the reality was that he was striking down south, that all the time he was going down against the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, he was fighting against the enemies of Israel. And as such, of course, he was securing Israel's border down here on the southwest. So David was doing, in fact, a great deal of good as far as Israel was concerned, but there were greater events afoot. God now was intent upon bringing Saul to a final confrontation up in the valley of Jezreel. And so we get the situation occurring, and how easily it occurs in our lives too, where it is true as it is always true. Oh, what a complex life we create for ourselves. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. And David, who had deceived Achish, who had settled at Ziklag, now finds that he is being drawn into the battle against Saul, and he is being forced to go, he and his 600 men, all 600 of them this time, being taken up to the battle that was to be drawn against Saul and the Philistines. And who can say what David would have done if he had ultimately had to have fought? You see, you could say, couldn't you, that, all right, David had been asking for it, that he should never have gone down this particular route. He shouldn't have tried to deceive day after day. Instead, he should have done something different. And you could say, well, of course, he was estranged from God now, and God would let him have his comeuppance. In other words, God wouldn't intervene. God wouldn't help him out of this. He'd just let the mess get messier. He'd wait until the very time when David had to issue a command to his 600. Was he or wasn't he going to fight against Israel? Well, was he forced into this situation or what? But you remember how God, who bends the minds of kings and Philistines alike, is able now to so control and so relieve the situation so that Achish says, "I've got a goodly band of people here," and the rest of the Philistine lords said, "Wait a minute. Aren't they Israelites? Aren't we fighting against the Israelites? Aren't the Israelites in front of us and Israelites behind us? Send them home." And Achish says, "They've been really good, you know. They've been really, really good for a long period of time. Send them home." And David goes back home then with his mighty men to Ziklag. And suddenly you realize that if you live the Philistine life, you must accept the Philistine problems too. God is remarkably gracious to us, isn't he? In our circumstances, in our complex lives, when our tangled loyalties, you know, cross over into areas and associations that we should really have nothing to do with, God unravels and cuts the Gordian knot. God allows us to be rescued and redeemed from our own complexities. But the consequences we have to bear. And the same was true now for David. Because as he began to head back, you remember now that he was heading back. There's an interesting little detail in his return journey. He's going back now to Ziklag. The interesting detail is that as he returns to Ziklag, so other people join him from the camp of Israel. It's worth just picking up the detail. Come and have a look in 1 Chronicles chapter 12. You get in 1 Chronicles 12 a record of the people who had come to join David, and the beginning of 1 Chronicles 12 says, "Now these are they that came to David to Ziklag, while he yet kept himself close because of Saul the son of Kish. They were among the mighty men, helpers in the war," and so they're catalogued and listed. There at verse 8, "And of the Gadites there separated themselves unto David into the hold to the wilderness, men of might and men of war." And there at verse 16, "There came of the children of Benjamin and Judah to the hold unto David." Now at verse 19, "And there fell some of Manasseh to David when he came with the Philistines against Saul to battle." Notice what happens, that the troop of David is enlarging and growing at different stages during David's experience, some to the hold, some whilst he was going to fight against Saul. They were actually joining his ranks. And there at verse 23, "These are the numbers of the bands that were ready armed to the war and came to David to Hebron." So there were more then that came and joined him later on. In other words, like ourselves, not everybody came and joined David at once. There were some who were first, and there were others who were last. And some of those who were last, well, they were only joining David as he came back to Ziklag, or as he went there in the last year or so of the life before David would become king at Hebron. And more of them still that were ready armed to war, and they were defecting from Benjamin, Saul's own tribe, and from Judah, as they could see the situation deteriorating. And there's another little detail here now, because of course, when they get back to Ziklag, what should they discover back in the record in 1 Samuel? But Ziklag has been burned with fire. I said that God is remarkably gracious to us, but the consequences we have to live through. You know, God accommodates us sometimes in our emotional needs. We may, for example, engage in marriage, which is outside the faith, and we may be reconciled with the ecclesia in that situation. But we should never delude ourselves that the consequences of that act will go away. We bind ourselves to ongoing consequences. And David was precisely the same in this instance. He had lived the Philistine life. Now he would suffer the Philistine problems. And returning to Ziklag and finding it desolate, he finds himself on the point of death, because his own faithful men were in fact now ready to put him to death. Such was their anguish and their agony. And David, of course, man of God as he is, turns to God in prayer. The ephod, of course, was always there. God was able to give him direction. And he is told to pursue the Amalekites who had come up from the east. And off they go in hunt of the Amalekites. And interestingly enough, let's pick up the record in 1 Samuel chapter 29. They'd just made this journey back from the valley of Jezreel, so things had been enormously difficult there. Sorry, 1 Samuel chapter 30. Finding that situation, there's the inquiry of the ephod in verse 7 of 1 Samuel chapter 30. "I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod." Abiathar brought thither the ephod to David. "Shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? Pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all." So David went, he and the 600 men that were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those that were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. They find an Egyptian, they discover that the Amalekites are encamped. They realize that there is a way into the Amalekite camp. They are successful in recovering and obtaining all the gain. Verse 18, David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. There was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all, and David took all the flocks and the herds which they drave before them, other cattle, and said, "This is David's spoil." Then he comes back to the 200 men who rested by the brook Besor. Well, we can understand that. It was the weakness of their flesh. They journeyed down all this distance, And anyway, there were people who'd only just joined the group. So when it comes to the share out of the reward, how are they to cope with it? And David comes back to them, says verse 22. And verse 22, then answered the wicked men and men of Belial, of those that went with David, and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Then said David, ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us, who hath preserved us and delivered the company that came against us into our hand. For who will hearken unto you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part or share alike. It was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. You see the pattern now of the way in which the king, when he comes to share out the spoils, when he comes to share the reward with those who are his faithful followers. Behold, when he comes and his arm is strong and his reward is before him, he shares out not simply to those who have been there actively engaged on the battlefield. In other words, it's not going to be a list of speaking brethren or presiding brethren or arranging brethren, as it were, and the king sits there saying, oh yes, a recorder, well, that'll be a very good position for the kingdom. Instead, there is to be an understanding and a sharing out, a conferring of reward with all those who have performed whatever function it was that was necessary for the Lord's work. It was just as vital to have stayed with the stuff and to have preserved what they had, to have rested at the brook Besor, or to have gone and to have actually accomplished the battle, to have held the drawn sword in the hand. So there's a pattern and a picture here of how the king will respond when at last he comes into the glories of his kingdom. Because David now, of course, was going to Hebron, and in Hebron, there he was to be anointed king. And you would have thought that the whole long drawn out saga had at last come to its end. But when a man came to declare in Ziklag that Saul was dead, 2 Samuel chapter 1, again, all of a sudden the curtains come apart and you get one of those insights into the life of the man. Just think what we were recapping. Just think of the length of time that David had spent and all the waiting and the agony in which David then had been waiting for Saul's departure, and seemingly it had never come to an end. Now at last a man comes, and the record is that he comes and falls to the earth and does obeisance to David. David says, verse 3 of 2 Samuel 1, from whence comest thou? Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. How went the matter? Tell me. The people are fled from the battle. Many of the people also are fallen and dead. Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. Now, how would we have felt at the end of this great long period when the man who had made us his enemy had at last fallen? If you were suddenly to tear the curtains of our own life apart and look into the very recesses of our heart, wouldn't there have been relief? Wouldn't we have thought, well, thank goodness the waiting is over. At last, all that we've hoped for, all that we've longed for, all that we've been preparing for has come to its fullness. And suddenly you see godliness displayed in this man. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? You see, that was the nature of the man now, who had so controlled and schooled and developed his innermost character, that even when at last it seemed that the kingdom was come and that he could go to Hebron and there that he could be accepted, that his first thought was of grief and of compassion for those who had fallen. Now, we could understand it, of course, if he said, Jonathan was lovely in his life. He was a fine lad, and I'm sorry to see him die. But, well, it is so like the love of Christ, isn't it? That he can look with compassion and say that Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. So this man is surely ready then for this particular moment when he is at last delivered to the kingdom. And surely now everything for which he has waited is about to be given to him. Surely God will say, here is the kingdom. The dynasty that failed is past, and at last Hebron is to be the place from whence you will reign over Israel. But look, he was to wait now for some 7 years before, in fact, he would enter into being corporate king over the whole of Israel. For there were still some remnants of David's family. Ish-bosheth was still to be established. Abner was to secure him. They were to set up the kingdom in Mahanaim, across the Jordan to the east. And there was to be a separation and a division so far as the country was concerned. Just notice the detail in 2 Samuel chapter 2, and there at verse 8. It tells us that Abner, the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host. That be shipping that's coming close? Or is that a signal that indicates that the dinner is getting ready? Abner, the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and made him king over Gilead, and over the Asherites, and over Jezreel, and over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, and over all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Now, you look at a passage like that, don't you, and you think, well, perhaps there's something curious in the text. How can you have two kingdoms which are coexisting, one of which is for 2 years in length, and the other of which is for 7.5 years? Let me suggest to you that what was happening was that there was an interregnum, so far as the kingdom was concerned, across to the east. That the tribes over which Abner had control, in fact, only actually established a kingdom for 2 years. For the rest of the time, well, it was never very clear who was in command. Perhaps it was Abner who was de facto king. But it was only for 2 years that you could clearly identify a kingdom there. And in the meantime, in Hebron, consolidating and strengthening his position, David was established as a king for 7 years and 6 months. Now, if indeed that's the case, and there is no textual evidence to suggest that 2 years should in fact read 7 years, then it would seem to suggest that David did now what he had long learned to do. He did nothing. I'm not suggesting that this was altogether a wise thing, but you watch for this characteristic in David's continuing experience. What the kingdom had told him was, what the wilderness had told him rather, was that it pays to be passive. He had learned to sit upon his hands. You remember, just let me strike him once and I shall not strike him again. No, we'll not do anything. Even when he does something and does that little bit of crude work with the scissors, as it were, and cuts off the hem of Saul's garment, at once he thinks he's done something too much. He is a man now whose main accent is passivity. And yet he was in a rather difficult position, because events were about to move with some considerable pace. You remember the sequence of events that was due to take place. As now Ish-bosheth was to grow weaker, so David in fact was to grow stronger and stronger. Abner was to be found against Joab. There was that sort of parallel that was to take place. And gradually there was to be upset and difficulty as circumstances eventually led to the death of Ish-bosheth. And here's a curious thing. Somebody creeps into the record now who suddenly takes the place of Saul. Saul, of course, is dead. He is dead upon the battlefield. But now we get another foil appearing to David. so that we can the better appreciate David and his qualities and his characteristics, we now find Joab emerging, black-hearted Joab. Joab, who is the man who does things and who does them violently and passionately. You see that, of course, most characteristically in what was to happen with regard to the battle at the Pool of Gibeon. Remember the circumstances where Joab and Abner met together and they say to themselves, let's put all this conflict and difficulty to an end. Let's pose some champions who will fight, representatives on our behalf. And so young men are chosen on both sides. And they go to fight a duel, as it were. And as a result, both groups fall dead. And so the battle is not decided because they are all dead on the ground. And so it is decided that Abner will return to Mahanaim and proceeds now to flee back to Mahanaim with the remnants of the army that had come to meet at the Pool of Gibeon. And you can still find the Pool of Gibeon, incidentally. Archaeologists have dug it out and discovered it there with those steps that go down to the actual water level. But now it was that Abner was fleeing back to Mahanaim, and one young man locks himself onto Abner's heels. And he was fleet of foot, Asahel. And you remember what happens now. Abner is running along, and what has he got? He has got, of course, the accoutrement of the king. He has got his spear, and he will not let his spear go, although it must have been quite tricky for him to have been running with his spear, but running with his spear he is, and Asahel, who is fleet of foot and a younger man, is forever drawing closer, and a conversation ensues as they run back, in which Abner says to him, look, go and choose somebody a bit younger, will you? You know, pick on somebody your own size. Why should I get into trouble by killing you? And Asahel just will not let him go. Until at last, woof! Before you can see it, the haft of the spear has been driven back, and the record says that it strikes Asahel under the fifth rib. And there he lies dying with the spear, the sharp end outward and the blunt end inward, with the spear which has penetrated him. And of course, along comes Joab and finds his young brother dead or dying. And yet, David was pursuing a policy in Hebron, which was itself a city of refuge, in which he was hoping that he might come to an accommodation with Abner. And whilst Joab has been away on one occasion, David and Abner meet, and Abner is willing to bring together the two factions and to unite the kingdom in one. And when Joab returns, they say to him, David's been meeting Abner, you know. And Joab says, call him back. And when Abner returns, unknown to David, Joab and Abner meet together, and the record says that as Joab went to embrace him, Abner failed to see the knife that was in Joab's hand. And where do you think it went? The record says, under the fifth rib. There it was, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, blow for a blow. What Asahel had received, so now Joab delivers, and Abner receives. And the important part that comes out of that particular episode is not the episode in itself, black-hearted though it was, for there was an offer of reconciliation, there was a prospect of the peace process, uniting the two groups together without bloodshed, but it is now what David does as a response. Remarkably, he laments but does nothing. David, in fact, laments in a fairly significant way, in the sense that, well, pick up the record in 2 Samuel chapter 3. Look at verse 31. David said to Joab and to all the people that were with him, rend your clothes and gird you with sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David himself followed the bier. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept. And the king lamented over Abner and said, died Abner as a fool dieth? Thy hands were not bound, nor thy feet put in fetters. As a man falleth before wicked men, so fellest thou. And all the people wept again over him. And yet you see, verse 39, I am this day weak, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, be too hard for me. The Lord shall reward the doer of evil, according to his wickedness. Now, do you notice the sequence of what's happening here? This man who has learned passivity is passive at a time when he should have been active. Well, he does do one active thing. Look what he says there at verse 28. When David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before the Lord forever from the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there not fail from the house of Joab one that hath an issue, or that is a leper, or that leaneth on a staff, or that falleth on the sword, or that lacketh bread. He curses Joab in very forthright terms, but he does nothing. You see, that aspect of David's life goes to show that our preparation is never complete. He had learned one aspect of the warrior's armor. He had learned the fact that you have to wait on God and have to be utterly dependent on the way that God will work things out and the course of providence as it unfolds before us. But David's life from here on also now demonstrates that you need to do things yourself, which are the right things that need to be done. Because if you don't intervene and take action when action is clearly needed, and here was Joab, of course, clearly in breach of the law. Joab had killed a man in a Levitical city of refuge, which he was not entitled to do. If David had taken action now, think what he would have spared himself from the sorrows that were to come. Sorrows that were to come, which Joab would play an important part in. So when you say to yourself, why didn't David take action? Well, of course, there are two answers. He didn't take action because, first of all, Joab was family. You remember Joab was related to David through Zeruiah, his sister. He was his nephew. And so David didn't take action because he was in the family. And furthermore, Joab had stayed with him through the wilderness deprivation. They had suffered together. They had shared together. There was that bond, that unity. But didn't stop David breaking the bond or the unity in other cases with people who had been equally affiliated with him. So it was a combination of things. It was a combination of personal feeling and family loyalty. Those are the hardest issues we too confront, aren't they? It's ever so difficult. We see things so clearly in an abstract situation. And then something happens within the family. We can't see it at all because, well, there are so many other complex layers that exist between our thinking and our doing. And so David's inadequacy in this respect, when he might have saved himself so much harm, is in fact our own inadequacy too. And two things now happen. When they come at last, at the end of the collapsed Ish-bosheth kingdom, and Abner's death, when they come at last to make him king in Jerusalem, two aspects occur. And it's intriguing that in the Chronicles record, you get those two things united together. First of all, there's an account of David's anointing in Jerusalem when all tribes come together, when they go from Hebron to Jerusalem. You remember the circumstances then when the Jebusites, who had held that little refuge there in the midst of Israel, say to them, ha-ha, even the lame or the blind could keep this place secure. This is Jerusalem 3,000 years ago, remember, when David comes at last to the little citadel, and when he says, whoever it is who can penetrate up the water course, doubtless, you see, they had realized a long time back, because water would have been of the very essence of their survival in the wilderness, they doubtless recognized that there was a spring, the spring of Gihon. And perhaps they'd been able to penetrate the way that it had been blocked from the outside. No doubt they kept it concealed with bushes or cover of some sort, but no doubt they'd been able to get access to that watering place in the past. And they must have realized that there was a way up. Whoever he says can get up the water course, he'll be my commander in chief. That was Joab's job. So that was competition for Joab's job that was declared on the basis. He'd done nothing. He'd taken no action, but suddenly he puts Joab's job on the line. And who do you think it is who climbs up the water course? Of course, it's Joab. He's not going to let anybody else take over from him. So Joab, who, mighty man as he was, of course, and very able commander and warrior, is able to penetrate up the watercourse, and so the Jebusites are ousted and the city is taken. An ideal placement, as you know full well, on the very border between Judah and Benjamin, the very place where the ancient alliance with Saul of Benjamin and the Judahites, the very place where it can be brought together and healed, and where there can be security and solace. That's the very place that David now takes and makes his capital. So the king who comes establishes a political center in the very midst of his people. But the other account in the Chronicles record, in fact, says that no sooner had they anointed David king in Hebron than he summoned all the people together, and they now proceeded to go in pursuit of the ark that was at Kirjath-Jearim, the city of the forest, the city of the woods. David had long anticipated and hoped for a time when the ark would be brought back into the center of Israel, and it's a fascinating record. Brother Harry Whittaker's book, Samuel, Saul and David, well, it's there, that Brother Harry brings together the catalogue of the people who in fact now are associated in the procession. There are the high priests, Abiathar and Zadok. There are the six groups of Levites, 862 of them in all. Three leaders of the service, Heman, Asaph and Ethan, the choir leaders. The men of the Mishnah, the scribes. The maidens choir, the Alamoth. The men's choir, the Sheminith. Kenaiah, who was the choir master or the ark keeper. Two doorkeepers of the ark. Seven priests with trumpets. The ark itself, two doorkeepers. And who should come then, clad in a linen ephod, and sacrificing as they went, but the king who was the priest? And so you have the very pattern of a religious procession as the ark of the Lord of hosts progresses into Jerusalem to be in the midst of God's people. You have the very pattern of the king priest, Melchizedek, who goes himself now with the procession, sacrificing as he went, and the record's emphatic and clear that David was himself offering the sacrifices, who, when he gets to Jerusalem, blesses the people in the name of the Lord, doubtless issuing the high priestly blessing, who feeds them bread and wine, or bread and raisin cakes, depending on your version and your translation, who therefore ministers to them and who satisfies their need, the very pattern of the man who then goes and sits in the very presence of the king and receives the Davidic covenant. You remember that detail in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where David sits down in the presence of the ark of the Lord, and that's Psalm 110. The Lord said to my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. So you see the build-up then, and the way in which all these things draw us forward towards that time when our king comes to Jerusalem. I suppose there is a sense now in which we are at the Hebron stage, in which we are being prepared as a people who are purposing to go towards Jerusalem, who are setting our faces towards Jerusalem, who are looking for that political entity that is to be established, and who are looking for the coming of the Ark of the Lord. And one other detail that makes it so clear that this was the culmination of David's purpose, and as it were the very end of his pilgrimage, is that not only was he sacrificing, not only was he exercising a Melchizedek priest-like role, but he was also purposefully praying, and later was to write his prayers as psalms. You see, there's a whole catalogue of psalms that David was writing as he proceeded towards Jerusalem. We'll just look at one of them as our very last study for the morning, and it's Psalm 24. And it makes us remember then that all these things draw and attract us towards the place of the presence of the king. And what does David say there in Psalm 24? Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, verse 3? And who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. He shall receive the blessing from the Lord, and righteousness from the God of his salvation. See, God is preparing us in the same way, bringing us through the wilderness pilgrimage, making us people who are waiting upon him, encouraging us to be active in the things that need action, saying to us that the reward will be for those who are in the front line and the ones who stay with the baggage, all the time urging us on to follow the model of the man who has gone before. And then he is saying to us, lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? And the record says, the Lord of hosts. The Lord, the deliverer, the redeemer, who is manifest in a multitude of his people. The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. May it be that by God's grace and in his mercy, each one of us might be associated in that host of the redeemed when at last the King comes to Jerusalem.